It's time to make it count. We give professionals the knowledge, mindset, and habits to win at work and at home. I'm Freddie Bennett, Guinness World Record holder, business owner, adventurer, and author, giving you the tools to get unstuck, unshackled, and unleashed. The clock is ticking, so let's go and make it count. It's time for another show-stopping episode of Make It Count. And today, folks, I've got a real treat for you. I am delighted to welcome a person who I truly see as a real underground legend of the accounting world in New Zealand, Australia and beyond. I am delighted to welcome today Mr. Greg Sheehad. Greg, welcome to Make It Count.
Pretty, thank you. What an introduction. I love that. Well, I feel like I should have paid you for that one. That's fantastic. Thank you.
Well, no, I'm excited about this one, Greg, because I know the stories that we're going to tell. I know the insights and the pure wisdom bombs that we're going to be dropping on the Make It Count listeners today. And that's why I know this is going to be one of these classic episodes. But Greg, let's really start from the top. Tell us a bit about yourself and your background.
Oh, thank you, Freddie. Look, I am a chartered accountant by trade, and I think with your audience that has, I guess, some resonance. In fact, I'm a fellow of the Institute, as we used to call it, now Chartered Accountants Australia New Zealand, and I love having my origin in accounting. I kicked off my career more in the corporate world. I was with Nike for about 5 years. I was with Air New Zealand for a similar time in, you know, senior kind of finance roles. And then I jumped across into the world of public practice in 2006. And then in 2011, I met one of the 2-0 co-founders who was also a chartered accountant. And we built a business from there, which I could get into. Spent a bit of time in and around that Xero ecosystem for the last, well, pretty much not long after Xero got started. So, yeah, I'm sure there's lots of threads we could pull on there.
Amazing. I love it. And I love the way that you just jump in there at the start. Yeah, you know, just a bit with Nike, a bit with Air New Zealand. We've got to go Nike to start with. How did that all come about? Was that one of your first roles as an accountant?
Yeah, well, pretty early on. I actually had my sister at the company. She was what we used to call a retail merchandiser. So one of those people who would make Nike stores, when we used to have a lot more Nike stores around the place, she would make them look cool. And of course, I just thought she just had one of the most epic roles. And I was an accountant. I wasn't doing anything as exciting as she was, but I thought, look, it would be so awesome to work for them. And I started off as the group or the company accountant, I think it was, in New Zealand, and then ultimately became CFO of Nike Australia. So moved the family across to Melbourne and joined Nike. It's a super cool company to be a part of. Loved my time there.
Mm, and I think you're right. It's such a cool brand, and especially to be in that position. And I'd love to ask this question on behalf of all the people that they're accountant to say within different brands and different companies. And as you say, when you joined the business, it was with a relationship with your sister and a connection that she had there. How did you rise from joining the company to that CFO position? Was there any kind of secret to your success at all?
Do you know, it's a great question, and I think it's something that accountants should consider if they are wanting to progress up the, you know, the chain of command. I'll be honest, I'm not actually a great accountant. I'm okay. You know, I know my debits from my credits. It would frustrate me if I couldn't get my trial balance to not balance. But I don't love accounting. I don't love being, you know, knee deep in work papers and things. And so what I do love is I love connecting with people, and I love, you know, finding out about people's stories. I think when you're in the accounting world and you're able to communicate with others and form connections, ideally can inspire and lead, your chances of succeeding and growing and moving up the corporate hierarchy are just so much better. So, look, I think I was in many ways, I was in the right place at the right time. I had a really fortuitous opportunity. I'd gone to Melbourne actually to become the financial controller of the Australian business. And while I was there, I was asked by the CEO of Nike Australia if I wouldn't mind jumping up to become CFO because they had just had the CFO leave. And so, you know, I think I was 28 at the time. And so I had a huge amount of self-doubt and, you know, let's call it imposter syndrome about me stepping into that role. But I did, and I jumped in, and yes, super scary, massively outside of my depth, but learned so much during that time. So it was, I guess, very much in the right place at the right time as well, Freddie.
I think that's a great position. We talk about this a lot in various episodes of Make It Count. It's that whole aspect of making your own luck. And you're very modest, and I very much appreciate that. Like, oh, you know, right place, right time. But I always believe that there is, for all of us in life, it is a case of making our own luck. And it's literally and metaphorically being willing to take that first step forward, to get on the plane, to get outside your comfort zone, to keep taking the action, even though you might have felt like an imposter. And it sounds like that's what you did.
Yeah, and I was actually sharing some of your wisdom around this with somebody over a coffee this morning, and just this whole concept that we shouldn't wait for confidence before we take an action, that we take the action and that gives us the confidence. And I'd heard that from you, and I just think that's so profound. It's so true. Look, I don't know if I was at the time a 28-year-old Greg. I don't think I was thinking about it like that. But looking back, I can see how diving into this challenge that really, it really did scare the living daylights out of me. And for probably the first 6 to 12 months, I just felt so out of my depth. I was at the leadership table, you know, every week. And I was surrounded by these people who, in my mind anyway, were just so much better than me. Mm. Yet I grew so phenomenally through that time. My confidence grew, my knowledge grew. And so looking back was probably one of the times in my career where I advanced, you know, the fastest.
Definitely. And I think there's a feeling that can resonate certainly with myself and with a lot of the listeners as well. It's that whole, when am I going to get found out? And it can be difficult Absolutely. To operate with that fear. And I think you make a great point that it isn't about overcoming the fear or beating the fear or trying to hide the fear. It's actually saying, I'm going to keep moving forward, even though I'm scared, even though I'm nervous, even though I feel like an imposter, I'm still going to put my hand up. I'm still going to put my best foot forward.
Yeah, and I would say now, in the sort of, you know, more mid-career, I still call it that, in my mid-50s, that when I'm feeling that sense of being out of my depth or feeling anxious or feeling, you know, scared, it's because I'm in exactly the right place. Like, that is the feeling I need to have. I need to feel that level of, it's almost like this quiet hum that sits there of anxiousness, to know I'm in the arena. This is exactly where I need to be.
I love that. I love where we are literally dropping the wisdom bombs within the first 10 minutes. It's like talking to myself, Greg. We can tell we've recorded some of your podcasts
together. Run across the Sahara or the Arctic, Freddie, and have no plans to.
But I don't recommend anyone does that, by the way, because I've still got the scars to prove it. But you're right, though, Greg, that these frameworks, these ways of thinking, of taking action, can apply to all of us. We don't, and as I say, you don't have to do crazy runs across the Arctic like I did. The feelings and the emotions that we encounter are the same, whether it is if you're in a meeting feeling like I don't belong here, or you're being asked to step into a new role and you're doubting yourself. It's the same. And talking about going into new roles, how did it come about that you went from more of the corporate side of accounting into public practice? Was that a waking up one morning and thinking, I want to go in this direction now? Was it more gradual? What went on in that process?
Yeah, it's interesting. So from the time I'd moved from corporates, I then spent some time in not-for-profits before I then went and ran my own practice. And so it's kind of an interesting one. I was probably in my early 30s. I'd had the, you know, I'm using air quotes, success at Nike and at Air New Zealand. And I'd had some really good roles. And I had this yearning to do something that had more meaning and more purpose. Not to say that those roles didn't have meaning and purpose, but I was looking for something. And so I spent some time running a charity for a period of time. And then I actually went into politics. I ran one of the main political parties in New Zealand for a time. And actually through that political experience grew almost deeply unhappy with just the nature of politics. It's a bit of a blood sport at times. But I'd spent some time probably for about a year prior where I'd moved into a small but beautiful regional town in New Zealand, a little town called Martinborough, with my wife and kids, and we kind of moved there. And so I was looking for lifestyle. And so at that point made the shift into what I thought was more of a lifestyle business, became a public practitioner, started an accounting practice, and had to go through this huge learning curve of learning about tax, which I wasn't particularly knowledgeable about, having come from a corporate environment at that point.
I love that when, I think something like tax usually isn't the kind of thing we just want to pick a number and make it up and say, yeah, you know, there or thereabouts, that'll be fine. But I think you make a great point, Greg, in terms of that continuous learning. And even though we may reach a level of success, as you say, then there are still other challenges. They always say you shouldn't be the smartest person in the room. And that fact that you're willing to step outside and with the nonprofit and the political side as well and embracing new challenges. And I imagine there's lessons you've learned about yourself and about dealing with people along the way.
Yeah, that's right. I started this practice of my own and then learned that I didn't really want to work on my own. I'm not very good just literally being a sole practitioner because I had to do too much of the work myself, to be honest. And then I formed a partnership with a cool local guy, and we had a two-partner accounting firm. And then, I don't know, a few years after that, 4 or 5 years after that, met one of the Xero co-founders. And that was, you know, we can get into that as much as you like, because we built, a pretty successful business until it wasn't successful. We had I can take you through that. So that journey. But there was kind of this interesting period where, you know, I was probably in my mid-30s by this point, and I was looking for lifestyle. I lived in this beautiful place, had this young family. Lifestyle was great. But I grew bored very, very quickly with that sort of small lifestyle practice.
I think it's an interesting challenge. And I've got, usually for me, quite a controversial view on this, is that we always say that we want this freedom. And it's always talked about, I want the money freedom and the time freedom and the lifestyle and everything else. I think we all want that. But sometimes when we get it, we realize that it's not actually what we want, and we do need freedom with purpose, freedom with meaning. My thinking is, if you put a sailor on a ship and you give them freedom from the shore but they don't have a compass, then they're never really gonna either know where they're going or have the courage to leave the freedom of the shore. Just like a train, if you give a train freedom from the railway tracks, then you're going to have a train wreck pretty quickly. So I think it's so easy just to throw around this idea of freedom this, freedom that. But when you actually get what you think you want, then you start to get the nagging doubt of, actually, I need something else here as well to sprinkle on top, a bit of chili powder to keep things a bit spicy. Is that what you found in terms of needing something to get your teeth into?
Yeah, I've got the attention span of a 3-year-old, and probably the attention span of a 3-year-old that's just had a sugar hit. You know, like I get bored very, very quickly. And so freedom was great. Like it was awesome. I had this little practice that was literally, you know, a 10-minute walk from my house, or a, you know, 2-minute, 1-minute drive in the car if it was raining. This lovely little town, this beautiful wine village, lovely, just perfect. And it fitted in with the young family, and I could go and pick the kids up from school and that sort of thing. But I'm an ambitious rooster, and I guess I have been, you know, most of my life, I guess. So I grew bored with freedom after a while. I wanted more. And interestingly, and we can push on this at some point if you want, but, you know, I'm in my mid-50s now, and a couple of years ago I had this real epiphany and need for, actually, I've probably got 30 years left. If I'm lucky, you know, and I don't get hit by a bus or eaten by a shark, it's another story. I want to live 30 years really vibrantly, and I want to do that in a way that challenges me and pushes me. And so I've made some big personal changes to go and affect that. But yeah, at the time I just had grown bored and needed something bigger to bite my, you know, to get my teeth into.
I totally, that very much feels very familiar to me as well. And by the way, I do love the term the ambitious rooster. That's the podcast episode title sorted. So thank you very much for that. Right. And we talk about having something else and that ambition. And I always believe that we can't deny our true nature. And I've found this as well, being an ambitious person and then trying to tell yourself, oh, I'm not ambitious, maybe, and almost beating ourselves up for wanting what we truly desire. I believe that if you try and be too well-rounded, then you take away your edge. So that's, I think, embracing and accepting, you know what, I am ambitious. Or for anyone listening, they may be saying, well, you know what, I am an introvert, I am this, I am that. We all label ourselves in a negative way. Why not own it and just say, look, this is me, to quote the song, this is who I am, this is what I want to do, now I'm going to go and do it. And this is where I'd love to explore the, as you touched upon, Greg, the meeting with the Zero co-founder and that whole side of the business. And as you say, you talk about building it up to this success. And what was the business and what was that journey?
Yeah, so this was interesting. I was in partnership with a guy in Martinborough. We had this lovely little practice. We had about 10 or 12 staff. We'd met a third guy who was another local, and he knew the Zero co-founder. So when Zero started, there were two of them as co-founders. Rod Drury was the IT entrepreneur and Hamish Edwards was his accountant. They had an 80-20 split on Zero when it was first incorporated, and then got, you know, new people to join them. And you know, the Zero story is another story again, a very, very impressive story. I met Hamish. Hamish was living in Greytown in the Wairarapa in New Zealand. And I guess I saw something in him that really lit me up. He was an accountant at the time. He's no longer an accountant. He's very well, he's got a lovely lifestyle now as a result of his success with Zero. But he lit something up in me, which was the sense of everything is possible. And he and I and the other two guys I mentioned, my business partner at the time and this third individual, we decided that we could start an accounting services business that could scale and scale quickly. And the thing with most accounting firms, they actually find it quite hard to scale because they have partners, and to grow, they need to add another partner. And to add another partner means their decision making just gets a little bit more fragmented because there's another, you know, girl or guy around the table to consider. So we thought we would come up with this unique model that would allow us to sort of get around that but still scale. And we had phenomenal success, as I say, until we didn't. So the four of us hired our first employee. We got a few clients together. We had a little office in Greytown. We had this little beer fridge that we used to use in photos. Social media was fairly new at the time, but we'd sort of use social media to promote ourselves. I love public speaking, so Zero would use me to speak at their events around the world, what they call ZeroCon in Australia, the US, New Zealand, etc. And we grew phenomenally. So every year we would double in size, both revenues, client numbers, staff numbers. And for about 6 years, I was CEO of the business. Hamish, who was the Zero co-founder, was chairman. For about 6 years, we doubled in size to the point where we had about 150 staff. And through that time, you know, we'd opened up offices in Australia. We were through New Zealand. I think we had about something like 15 offices at the time. And we were starting to get a real reputation as being something that was going to kind of take over the accounting world. It's interesting in this because I kind of, through this process, attached my own identity to that brand identity. And again, we can look at this, but I lost my identity through that process. And that's probably a separate thing to explore if we get time. But I had this moment where we were in Australia. We had this black tie event. We were launching our Australian business. We had dignitaries. We even had a mechanical bull, which might not have been smart given it was actually out on a balcony on the 22nd floor of an office tower in Sydney with very small railings around it and not much between the bull and the street below. Anyway, I can remember this moment. It was like a Wolves of Wall Street moment where I just felt on top of the world. Probably about a month later, we had a legal action taken out against our business. And I won't go into all the ins and outs.
Was it the bull?
We had, sorry?
Was it the bull, the legal action?
Yeah. Yeah, we lost three people over the side of the building. Well, I thought I'd successfully dealt with their bodies in Sydney Harbour, but apparently they found them. No. No, just kidding. But no, we had a challenge on our business model, and we'd put the business model together with a large law firm, and we traded with that business model for 6 years. We'd had 50 accounting partners sign up to the model. We'd had 50 different law firms look at the model because they were representing these 50 partners. Long story short, the model ended up being proved to be illegal under New Zealand law. And unbeknown to all of us, we ended up sort of getting really caught. But look, it was a time, it was incredibly hard. I lost myself in that process. I kind of almost went off the rails a little bit, really. And because I'd attached my identity to the brand identity, and the brand identity was publicly failing, it was a real, a pretty tough time. Looking back now, you know, you look at those moments in time and you think, you know, I don't want to ever go through that again, but I'm also somewhat grateful for what lessons it taught me. The business is still going. It's nothing like probably what it was at the time, or certainly the aspirations we had for it. But in terms of life experiences, you know, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. It was phenomenally tough mentally and on those around me. But yeah, as I say, a real time of learning.
It sounds like a hell of an experience. And I was going to say, I've had my own Wolf of Wall Street experiences, but that's probably something for a different podcast. But it must have hurt your ego a lot. I think, again, I know there's a controversial school of thought out there that some people subscribe to, is that we actually subconsciously create the thing that we fear the most. So someone who is their biggest fear in their life is losing their business and losing all the money. It is possible for people to subconsciously create those conditions. Same as someone whose biggest fear is their partner leaving them, and they'll do things to make that happen. Because if we think of life, and I often talk about the professional superheroes, if we think of life like a superhero movie, then the superhero has to face their greatest enemy in order to win the day. And it sounds like this was one of your greatest battles. And you talked about it being dark and being scary. And were there ever any moments when you thought, we're never going to be able to get through this? Or just when it felt like there would never be a light at the end of the tunnel?
Absolutely. And constant. I remember, I'm always, when I think back to that time, I mean, there were multiple moments where I had my head in my hands. There were multiple moments where, you know, I could feel myself almost physically burning up with anxiety. There was one particular night where we'd had a board meeting. I was on the board as CEO, I was on the board, and we had a board, you know, running the company. And the board had said to me, Greg, this issue is a big issue. We hadn't subsequently taken it to court, but we knew we needed to make some changes to our entire business model, which meant making some really tough calls. Because we were growing so fast, we were raising capital. I'd been in Sydney and Melbourne raising capital from investment banks, and yet this looming, almost like sword of was it Damocles, was hanging over me. And I had this night where we had the board meeting. The board had said, Greg, if we don't raise capital, you know, by the 31st of March, we need to close the Australian business down. We probably need to take a bunch of people out of the New Zealand business because we can't afford to keep going in the way that we're going. We're growing fast, but we can't raise capital to fund that growth. And I did not want to hear that. I was in denial. Again, this was attached to my identity. We were the fastest growing accounting partner that Xero had ever had. We were their largest partner at this point, I think, as well. And I just didn't want to hear this. And then we had the board meeting. I went back to my hotel in Wellington, New Zealand, that night, because I was flying out to Auckland, I think, the next day. 3 o'clock in the morning, and I'm lying there in bed. I'm physically sweating, even though it was quite a cold night. And remember just being in denial. And then I just had this moment where I thought, the board are right. They're right. We have to do this. And then the next day, or maybe the day after, we had another board meeting, we made all the changes that we had to, which again was incredibly painful. that period probably lasted a couple of years, you know, court actions and lawyers and lots of stress, really tough times.
What felt harder, the decision or the actions that you had to take after the decision?
I think the decision was the hardest. The actions were long and arduous and painful because you felt like you were constantly in this kind of, it's almost like a quicksand. It was just very negative. It was a very negative environment. But the idea of giving up on the dream, or what I thought was the dream, that was harder. Because I'd spent 6 years doing it. I'd built, you know, my identity around it. And I was, you know, we were in conversations with Xero about taking this business to the US.
Mm.
You know, this was going to be my tombstone, if you like. So yeah. Giving away that was going to be tough.
I think you make a great point as well, that we are so good at attaching our identity to external things. Because if anyone says, who are you? Then they will say, oh, I'm so-and-so, I'm a director at this practice, or I'm an accountant, or I'm a golfer, or I'm an Audi driver. We always attach our identity to these things that are outside of ourselves. And then when these things get taken away, that's when we, as you say, that's when we start to fall apart, because then we say, actually, who am I? And that could be a very scary question. It's all very, I could say it's a very empowering question, very freeing. But I know when it feels like everything is falling apart around you, and not just for a day, not just for a bad meeting, not just having a bit of a bad week here, as you say, for 2 years, you've got that going on. And how did that impact you outside of work, and how did you keep yourself sane through those? I know so many people go through dark times, maybe not on this scale, but certainly in these areas. So yeah, what was the impact, and how did you keep yourself together?
Yeah, like I'd love to say that I had, you know, a wonderful sort of morning routine and afternoon routine, and I was, you know, fit and healthy, but that's not my story. You know, I made some really bad decisions. I let myself go, you know, physically. I wasn't keeping fit. I just thought that the solution to this was to either escape it, you know, with drinking, or just ignoring it. I thought another solution was to just work harder and to try and almost muscle it out and just keep, you know, grinding it out. I had moments of shame. I had tremendous moments of shame. And it's interesting because I've seen the impact that shame can have on people. There was a well-publicized story a few years ago of a young guy, Jake Miller, a young Kiwi entrepreneur who flew high, had a business failure that was then sort of ripped apart a lot in the media, and a lot of people were sort of jumping on Jake's story, and they were either defending him or attacking him. And as a young guy, he could not handle that shame, and he subsequently took his life. And so I look at shame as a killer. It can be a killer, and it comes back to this whole sense of identity. Mm. Almost in an anthropological way, we need to feel connected. So if we feel shame, or if we feel we've lost our identity, or we're struggling with our identity, it's really crippling. And so, yeah, look, I wrestled with that. And, you know, I was a guy in my mid-40s by this point who should have been able to kind of handle this sort of stuff, but couldn't and didn't. And so, you know, now in my mid-50s, I'm, you know, I'd like to say I'm a bit more sage and a bit wiser, but it's truly these things that make us into who we are and to shape us in the way we are. I'd like to say I'm a more graceful character. I'm a more understanding person. I love connecting with people and hearing their stories because, hey, we've all screwed up. We've all made mistakes. We've all done things that we wish we hadn't, but that, to your earlier point, they're the things that give us our edge. They're the things that shape us.
Exactly. And I love what you say there, Greg, about shame. And I truly believe it as well. Shame is such a massive driver in our lives. And taking it back to that everyday accounting scenario, so I do a lot of work with that, you know, mid-manager level of accountants, client managers, accountants, and so on. And shame is what is underlying in so many of our actions and behaviors. I don't want to lead a client meeting in case I look stupid. I don't want to challenge this person in case I look like a fool. Shame tends to drive us to play not to lose rather than play to win. And I think if we want to all play to win, then we have to accept that shame is always something there. But actually, it's down to us whether we feel shame. No one can make us feel shame. I think people can say what they want to say. People can do what they want to do. But it is only our decision whether we feel ashamed of our actions or not.
That's exactly right. And we are very much the almost like the victim of what we think others will think of us.
Mm.
And as many of your listeners will well know, most of the time people aren't thinking of you. And yet we spend so much time worrying about what other people will think. And I think in the accounting profession, I think we perhaps suffer this a little bit more. We are, as accountants, we love order. And we love, debits do sit on the left and credits do sit on the right and numbers are meant to balance. We love structure, the fact that there's a tax authority that give us rules that we can abide by. We've got this almost a comfort layer that we live in, and we're very collegial in the accounting profession as well. So we like to know what our peers are thinking. We like to know that what we're doing is not outside the ordinary. And we do struggle at times to be, free and independent thinkers. There's some exceptions to that in the profession, and we need those people. But by and large, we can suffer a little bit from the sort of pack and herd mentality.
Quick pause to tell you something that I am so excited about. I have launched the Professional Superheroes Mastermind Group. This is where professionals work directly with me to develop the knowledge, habits, and mindset to get unstuck, unshackled, and unleashed at work and at home. There is nothing like this on the planet. It is mind-blowing how much fun this is and just how big a shift people are experiencing. We turn you into the professional superhero that you were always meant to be. If you want more information and to join, then drop me an email at hello@freddiembennett.com. That's hello@freddiem for mindset, BENNETT.com. I can't wait to see you in there. Now, let's get back to the episode. Yeah, I totally agree. And as someone who is notoriously very bad at following rules and regulations, I see both sides of that coin from my own perspective. But you make a really great point, Greg. And I wanted to actually link this back to something you said right at the start of the conversation as well, when you said, I don't love accounting, but I love connecting with people. And if we think about the listeners right now who are looking to either scale their accounting practice or scale their business or even scale their career, and we think about the importance of connecting with people, what advice would you give to someone who say, right, I want to get to the next level, I feel like I'm kind of getting in my own way somehow? How do they move forward and scale to become the person, the accountant, the professional that they've always wanted to be?
Yeah, I think the first thing is just actually accepting that is the path to you being more successful, winning more clients, progressing up the hierarchy, getting the promotion is 9 times out of 10, possibly more, going to come down to your connectivity with other humans. Can you inspire? Can you sell? Can you lead in a way that people want to follow? I always say to people that if you want to be a leader, you can have whatever it is that's written on your business card. You can be the most senior person in the organization. But by definition, and I actually talk to my children who are all adults now, but I talk to them about leaders have followers. By definition, leaders have followers. If you look behind you and you don't have a whole bunch of people wanting to follow you, then you're not leading. And you're probably not a leader. So how do you turn that around? You have to recognize that, this is probably a bunch of different attributes here, but one of the things is recognizing that people have a desire for leadership. They want somebody to encourage them, to inspire them, to give them the space to grow. As accountants, and I've seen this firsthand, where a lot of managers and leaders want to control their teams. Get out of the way of your teams. Measure outputs, not inputs. Don't be looking at the 6-minute unit so much as what was produced and by when. Let people work where they want to work. Sure, they need to be able to be available between sort of working hours, but if they want to work somewhere else, let them work somewhere else. Don't be sitting over their shoulder, you know, looking at their work. Measure the outputs. So give people the freedom. I think, and then in terms of, you know, your ability to inspire, do some courses, do some Toastmasters courses, et cetera. Do some training around how to become a better leader, how to engage with people. If it comes naturally, then just, you know, get out of your own way and let that flow. If it doesn't, then get some help.
I love that, Greg. If only there was something out there that could, like, take accountants and advisors and turn them into almost professional superheroes. That'd be,
I wonder what
crazy person would try and would create the world's leading mastermind to create professional superheroes. But I absolutely agree on a serious note of what you're saying. And I think it's, and I do believe on the superheroes part, like it is that superhero part of success. And part of it is that self-belief. I always say that you can't outperform your own self-image. So the first step is that you have to have the self-image that I can achieve this. But you're right, it is taking the action. It's looking at the evidence. It is getting quite scientific around it. I know a lot of people who would listen to this and say, that's all very well, but that's not me. And I think we fall into a trap of thinking that to be a leader, to be a professional superhero, to be successful, you need to be perfect. But I, as someone who is extremely imperfect, yet addicted to perfectionism, I absolutely say that isn't true. The hero isn't perfect. The hero is just the victim who's willing to face their challenges and transform. And to be heroic on our professional journeys, it's about not leaving our lives, the story of our lives, to fate, because fate is a terrible writer. And it's about saying, I have the agency, I have the control to actually choose what happens next. And as you rightly say, the first step to being a leader is to leading yourself.
That's exactly right. The other piece that I often reflect on is, and I've heard you mention this too, is how do we make the 8-year-old version of ourselves as well as the 80-year-old version of ourselves, you know, proud? What would those people want to say to us? And I reflect on that a lot. The 80-year-old version of myself, I want the 80-year-old version to look at Greg and say, Greg, you are graceful. Primarily, you are graceful. Now, to be graceful, and I think we've all met and experienced these people who, let's just say they've had some more challenging aspects in their life. Maybe they were a gang member at one point, or maybe they were even a criminal and they've turned their lives around. There's some really good examples in the media around this. But the people who have had these experiences often have challenged themselves to do things better and to have experiences that are perhaps different to what they were taught. There's a great model around looking at life in the sense that you can have order, disorder, and then reorder. So order is where you grew up with a set of rules, how you were meant to live. It might be the accounting profession. This is what good looks like. This is what bad looks like. This is what right looks like. This is what wrong looks like. And we often live within that first phase, that order phase. We then have something that happens, some big life event, some relationship breakdown, a business failure, some sort of, you know, health crisis, and we end up with disorder. It's a tumble dryer. It's a storm. We come out the other side and we are reordered. It's those people in the reordered place in life that generally have the most grace. And I think 80-year-old version of Greg would like to look back and go, well, you got to the reordered phase. And you became more graceful. You became more understanding of other humans and the connection you can have with them.
I love that. I've never heard it described either in that way or quite so eloquently before. So thank you for that, Greg. And as someone, I think if you gave everybody 100 words to choose to describe me, graceful would not be in them. But I would love to be graceful. So I will certainly focus on that reorder aspect. And speaking of the reordering of our lives, let's look at the present moment and today. So what is happening for you now? And we've talked about the high and the low and the fall. How did you pick yourself up, move forward, and where has that brought you to today?
Yeah, you have to, don't you? So about a year ago, you know, I was 53, 54 now, and I had this kind of almost like not even an epiphany. It was a slow burning desire for change in me that had been sort of bubbling away for a few years. So Christmas of 2022, just before that, my wife and I, my ex-wife, Nikki, and I had a very tough conversation. She's the most beautiful human you can ever imagine. Is also a chartered accountant. Wonderful, wonderful woman. But we had become kind of highly functioning flatmates. And we'd raised three incredibly cool young people who are now living their own lives. But for Nikki and I, we had started to drift apart at a sort of husband and wife level. And we'd become these highly functioning flatmates. We were kind of business partners more than we were, marriage partners. Yet we were still good friends. And so we had this very, very brave conversation about how do we both flourish. And we'd been married 30 years. In fact, we actually went on our 30th wedding anniversary after having this conversation. We were married, really quite young. And we were casting forward for the next 30 years, assuming we would live to, say, 83, 84, wondering what our lives would look like. So we ultimately made the decision to part, but did that, very, very amicably. I want to flourish from here, Freddie. I want to, a lot of people in their mid-50s start to think, this is life, and get trapped in whatever form of life they've got. Fuck that. Sorry, you're going to have to put the explicit warning on your podcast.
No, it's my own podcast. We're allowed swearing here.
screw that, right? Like this is, I get one life on this planet, regardless of what might happen when this life is over. And I want to live it really vibrantly and to flourish. And so I've got, I've got a podcast now in and around startups, and you've made a couple of features on that as somebody who's also made a massive transformation to your life, and what an incredible story you've got. So I'm loving doing that podcast. And I've also got a venture or two in Australia, a little bit early to talk about it at this stage, but I love startups and love seeing where pain is and where pain can be solved. So love working with highly energetic people, solving big problems. So yeah, look, I could not be happier with how life is panning out now. So really enjoying things.
That's amazing. And I absolutely love that, Greg. And the story is not over. There are many, many chapters still to write, but you hold the pen. And I think it is clear that not only are you flourishing, but your wisdom, your experiences, the story so far is going to help so many more accountants, advisors, and professionals to flourish. And we are coming to the end of the episode now, but obviously there is one more question to ask you, Greg, and that is the tradition here on Make It Count to ask the secret question. And this is when a previous Make It Count guest asks a question of the current guest, which is you. So I will delve into my secret question that I have not seen. And immediately I get annoyed because someone has broken the rules. And this is a two-part question. And you know the rules, everybody. There should be one question, not a two-parter, but we will roll with it. And it's interesting. I haven't seen this, but it's interesting now with regard to our conversation. So your secret question, Greg, which is a two-parter. What do you wish you'd done sooner? And what do you wish you'd never done?
Oh, God, that is such a good question. A very, very good question, or two questions, really, two parts. What do I wish I'd done sooner? I think I've never thought about either of these questions before. They're bloody good questions, whoever asked them. The first one, I think I wish I had become, and I'm going to use this phrase, an entrepreneur earlier. I had a great corporate career. I love my corporate career. But I also think I was kind of more hardwired to doing the entrepreneurial journey than living in corporate land. I was mid-30s or something before I started my first business, and I was probably in my early 40s before I started what was, high growth business. I wish I'd started that maybe in my 20s, even in my early 20s when I had no commitments. Mm. What do I wish I had never done? I'm struggling to think about this, but it's interesting. I don't actually have any regrets. I've done things, I've made mistakes, of course. I nearly wished that I hadn't gone for a surf recently because I encountered a shark. But I, you know, and I maybe I shouldn't have gone for a surf that day. But, you know, I never want to live with regrets. So in a sense, I struggle with this. I don't think there is something I wish I had never done, because I think if I lived like that, then I would never take risks. I'd never do things. So it's always, in my opinion, it's always about looking forward, not backward.
I love that. And the best opportunities are always ahead of us. And you're right, Greg, sometimes it can feel like we're all swimming with sharks, but with things like the knowledge that you're giving us in this episode, it's like everybody can see the safety of the shore. So Thais came up with that. That was quite good, wasn't it?
And so, I like that.
Yeah,
I like
thank
that.
Thank you.
Actually,
for...
let me share that, actually, from an encouragement point of view.
Let's have it.
A great quote, I think, is that when in life, it's a little bit like when you go fishing in a boat and you're getting the boat prepared and you're down on the shore. Mm. The people who will give you your greatest encouragement in life are people who fished way further out to sea than you. The people who will criticize you are the people who have never left the shore.
Oh.
And it's analogous to life.
I like that one. We're going to lock that in the Make It Count vault. That is that's gold-plated advice there. Love it. Thank you so much, Greg. And what a powerful note to finish on. I've absolutely loved this conversation. I think you're a hell of a guy. I feel honoured to know you and to be able to learn from you every single day. So thank you for being part of this show. If people want to reach out to you, if they want to hear your own podcast, which is growing fast and hugely successful, how do people find you?
So thank you, Freddie. And actually also, likewise, I have massive admiration for who you are as an individual and what you've achieved in life. And I'm super excited to see where you take things. People can find the podcast. It's called The Starting Up Podcast with host Greg Sheehan. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts.
Perfect. I will put the links in the show notes of this episode as well. Greg, it has been an absolute pleasure. We have got many more things to talk about. We'll have to get you back for a part two later in the year. But for now, thank you for being part of Make It Count.
Thank you, Freddie.
Thank you for listening to another show-stopping episode of Make It Count. I would love it if you could give us a 5-star review, subscribe, and share this podcast with the world. I am on a mission to get professionals unstuck, unshackled, and unleashed at work and at home. You can join our free Make It Count community. Click the link in the show notes, and you can also follow all of my adventures on Instagram at @TheFreddieBennett. Well, for now, we made it count once again. I've been Freddie Bennett. You have been amazing, and I will see you on the other side.